Friends, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, welcoming you to another edition of Valley Writers Read. Two stories tonight. The first is by Joe Hemphill and is entitled A Good Ending to a Story. It'll be read by Howard Hurt. And then our second story is by Bill McDougall and is entitled Bertha in Stillwell. But let's get started with our first offering. Written by Joe Hemphill, the title is A Good Ending to a Story. Here is Howard Hurt to read it for us.
A Good Ending to a Story. I wake up when I hear the breakfast cart rattle down the hall outside my door. Immediately after the rattling of the breakfast cart, someone switches on the light in the hall and the glare shoots under my door. The door suddenly bangs open. It is Gail. "Good morning, sleepyhead," she says. She's an aide. She sets the breakfast tray down on the rolling table at the foot of my bed and wheels it over in front of my typing desk. "I'll be right back to feed you," she says. She starts to walk out the door but sticks her head back in to tell me something else. "We have a new therapist. He'll be by to see you after lunch." The news about the therapist is upsetting to me. I just lie there taking it in. Holding onto the grab bar screwed into the wall on the left side of my bed, I manage to get into my wheelchair by the time she comes back. "Kind of slow today, aren't you?" I tell her I'm not young like she is. "That isn't an excuse." Gail has worked at the hospital for a few years. After a number of patients like me with cerebral palsy moved in, she became supervisor and has responsibility for the whole wing. "What does the therapist want to see me for?" "He has to see everybody," she says. I wear just underwear to bed, so she comes across and slips an old T-shirt over my head and my arms. Cerebral palsy causes my arms to be rather stiff, and it isn't easy to put a shirt on me. She wheels me over to the table where my breakfast waits. I wish I had my pants on rather than sitting here in that shirt and my underwear. As if reading my mind, Gail pulls a sheet off my bed and throws it across my lap. "I don't want you to get cold," she says. "I have to change your bed anyway. Eat up. I have two more people to feed." My breakfast consists of a bird in a nest, which is a piece of toast with a fried egg in the middle, some oatmeal, which looks and tastes like glue, and grapefruit juice and coffee. Because I can't close my mouth around the spoon very well, she scrapes the food off by pulling the spoon against my upper teeth. Most of my food has to be soft or mashed because I can't chew. I move the food around with my tongue, pressing it against the roof of my mouth until I can swallow it. She waits after each spoonful until I get the food down. After feeding me, Gail says, "I'll be back in a little bit to help you get dressed. See how far you can get by yourself." When she returns in 10 minutes, I have both legs in my pants and my blue shirt on. "Good boy, Jerry. You almost have your pants on, and that's a nice shirt. Hold on to the grab bar and stand up so I can pull your pants up." After Gail finishes getting me dressed, she leaves and I sit in my chair thinking. The idea of seeing a new therapist makes me angry. I really want just to say no to even meeting this guy. Don't I have the right to refuse therapy and make choices about my own life? I sit there for a long time thinking about all of this and reliving the falls I had taken while trying to learn to walk. It's scary to think about doing it all again. Why can't people just leave me alone to write? I push myself backward over to the door, and turning my chair around, I grab the doorknob and swing the door open. The doorknob bangs against the wall. I can't help it. Turning my chair around again, I push myself backwards into the hall with both feet. There's a round wooden handrail in the middle of both walls, all through the hospital, so people who can walk can hold on to it. I wheel up to the fourth wing and past the nurse's station. As I'm about to go down the third wing toward the dining room, I see Leslie walking toward me. I smile. She squats down and rests a clipboard on her knee. My check is on the clipboard, and she helps me get hold of the pen. Every month I have to sign my Social Security check over to the hospital. Then they give me $15 from my check for spending money. I can see Leslie's face up close. She's about 22 years old and very attractive. She has green eyes and a few freckles across her nose. Her cheeks are a little sunburned, and she's wearing pale pink lipstick. My hand starts shaking a little, so Leslie steadies it so I can sign my check. Her hand feels soft on mine, and I can smell her perfume. Her hair is dark brown, and I really want to touch it as it falls over her shoulders. Thank you, Jerry. Maybe I'll see you later while I'm on my break after I get off work. We can talk about your story if you'd like to. If you're ready to have me retype it for you, bring it along. I'm working late tonight, and maybe I can do your story when I'm through. The prospect of seeing her later that evening really brightens my day. I continue pushing myself backward down the wing, thinking how pretty Leslie is. For a few minutes, I actually forget about the therapist. I go down the hall, back to my room, and push the door closed. I go over to my typing table, put on my reading glasses, and pull the string that switches on the light over my typewriter. I pick up the stick I use to type. My electric typewriter has a metal plate with holes set just above each key. To type, I hold the stick in my left hand, sliding it across the plate to the key I want. I rest the side of my hand on the plate and roll my hand, which pokes the stick into the hole over the key I want. I switch on my typewriter. It's an old friend, but today I don't know what to say. I just listen to the hum of the motor. I glance at the pages of notes I had thought would be a story, but my mind just hears the hum of the typewriter. I listen to the hum for a while. Then I turn it off. I look out the window for a few minutes. For the past few days, I haven't known what to write. I could write about the other hospital where I'd been a few years ago, but I haven't been away from it long enough to get a true perspective on it. Maybe my creative juices have dried up. I guess that's what they mean by writer's block. I look back out the window. I again think about the new therapist. I think back to my last therapy session before leaving the day school 10 years ago. The memories are sharp and painful. The very thought of working with another therapist makes my heart race, and I break into a sweat. Mr. Sutter, my therapist at the day school, had come to help me out of my chair. He had begun walking me around the therapy room, holding onto my belt. I had spent 2 years there working with Mr. Sutter, and I was still not able to walk on my own. After we had walked around the therapy room for a few minutes, Mr. Sutter had said, "I'm going to let go of your belt now, and you'll walk alone." As soon as I thought he'd let go of me, I had fallen backward, and he'd caught me. "Jerry, you can walk alone. I just had one finger on your belt." I shook my head and kept repeating, "I can't. I can't." "Look," he said, "my finger in your belt isn't enough to hold you up. You were doing it yourself. This is your last day. I know you can do it." He had put me back on my feet and made sure I had my balance. "Your balance is perfect," Sutter told me. "Just walk away from me." I had stood there for a long time. I had known I wanted to walk away from him. I just couldn't do it. The fear of falling was intense and overwhelming. All the things in my life that would be better if I could walk had run through my mind. At home, I could play more games with my brother and his friends if I could walk. Mom would be proud of me, too, if I could walk. I told Mr. Sutter I was scared, and I started crying. I had said I couldn't do it. I couldn't. I was 15 years old, and I couldn't walk. God, I wanted to walk. But I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. I knew right then that I would never walk. It didn't make any difference how hard I tried or how much I wanted to do it. I was just never going to be able to walk. Mr. Sutter put his arms around me. "I'm sorry I was so hard on you," he said. "Forgive me?" "Yes," I said. I was still crying. I told him, I want to walk. I just can't do it." "I know." I told him how he had worked with me for 2 years and I still couldn't walk. "It takes longer for some," he said. "I wish there was a way for you to stay in the program one more year. Your balance is good. You just need to build up your self-confidence." I apologized for letting him down. "Wait a minute, buddy," he said. "You didn't let me down. I just wish you could stay in the program longer." It's been over 10 years since that day with Mr. Sutter. That was the last time I tried to walk. I had come close, but never could do it. Now this new therapist might want me to try. I just don't know if I can do all that again. I finally go over to my typewriter and start working on an outline for a new story. This keeps me busy for the next couple of hours. It feels good to be writing again, even though I'm not working on the story I'd already started. Maybe I can show my outline to Leslie. I realize it's time for lunch, and I leave my room and push myself to the dining room. When I reach the end of the third wing, I turn into the dining room, and Gail, from the corner where my table is, scolds me, half kidding, half serious. "Well, it's about time. I don't have all day to wait for you." She grabs my chair and pulls me over to the black-rimmed table where Chuck and Rick, another patient with cerebral palsy, are sitting in their wheelchairs. Gail says, "I'm feeding the three worst guys in the place. I think I should get double time." Rick works to put his spastic hand on Gail's shoulder. "At least Rick gives me a back rub," she says. We're having soup for lunch. Chuck can't close his mouth, so after Gail puts a bite in his mouth, she pushes his bottom jaw up. I ask her to put the bread in my soup to soften it so I can eat it easier. Rick just wants chocolate milk and cookies. Gail gives each of us one bite at a time, starting with Chuck and ending with me, until all three finish our lunches. It happens this way 3 times a day. Gail starts to wipe our mouths, stack our dishes, and clean up our table. She has to go help other residents and leaves us there for a while. I often wonder what's going on in Chuck's mind. I have a speech defect, but I can make myself understood after a while. And I have a letter board to spell words when everything else fails. But with Chuck, you have to ask him yes or no questions. He closes his eyes for yes and moves his unformed feet for no. I watch Chuck gazing out the window. He looks back at me and kicks the table, asking with his eyes what is wrong. I tell him I had a bad morning thinking about going through physical therapy again. He gives me a questioning stare. I tell him that I am really struggling with the whole idea and that I am not sure what I will decide to do. After lunch, I start wheeling toward my room. I take a detour and wheel past a small room that has a sign above it, physical therapy. This is where I would have it, if I agree to it. I continue on to my room, where I sit quietly, staring out the window again. Gail comes in. "Jerry, you aren't yourself. Where's my friend who always has a smile?" I tell her, "I don't want to have any therapy." "Why?" I tell her, "I tried that route once." "I didn't know that. Where was this?" "At the day school." "That was a ways back. Maybe this guy..." I cut her off. I tell her I don't want anything to do with him. "Jerry, I'm sure he won't make you do anything you don't want to do. He just has to see all the patients." She pats my shoulder to reassure me. "Well, I have to clean up another patient. I'll see you later." I wheel around the foot of my bed to my typewriter and the half-finished outline I started for the new story. I don't feel like working on it right now. I go back around to the window and watch cars pass by. A while later, I sense that there's someone in the doorway. I turn around and glance up, and there stands a man with light brown hair that touches the tops of his ears and hangs down over his forehead, almost reaching the top of his black-rimmed glasses. A beard covers most of his face, but it's been trimmed recently, probably so he could get this job. "Hi, I'm Bill," he says. I tell him my name. I hear the distortion of my own spastic speech. "Sorry, I didn't catch that." I say my name 2 more times. "Jerry, is that what you said?" I nod my head. "Well, Jerry, I'm the new therapist. Is it okay if I see how tight your legs are?" I nod assent. I think if I let him do this thing, he'll leave me and go bother someone else. He comes across and kneels in front of me, taking my right heel in one hand and putting his other hand on my knee. Then he slowly pulls my right leg out straight. In a few seconds, he lets my right foot go back to the floor. "That one's kind of tight, isn't it?" I smile. "Let's see how the other one is." He does the same thing with my left leg. "That one is a little better." He sees the bar on the wall. "Can you get in and out of bed by yourself?" I say yes. "Once more?" I say yes again. "I got it that time. You have to be patient with me. I'm not used to your speech. So, can you bear your own weight?" I nod, remembering Mr. Sutter. "It really isn't good for you to sit all the time. Why don't you come down to therapy, and I'll help you stand up?" I shake my head no. I look at my typewriter. I'd rather write. He glances at the machine. "You're a writer, I see. Is writing important to you?" I nod again. "But 15 minutes of therapy a day isn't very long. You would still have lots of time for writing. Will you think about it?" I hesitate, then nod again, reluctantly. Before I leave, will you show me how you get into bed? Maybe if I do that, he'll give up and leave me alone. So I turn my chair around and, locking my brakes, grab a hold of the bar and stand up. Hey, you can control your movements better than I thought you could. I sit back down. Did you ever try to walk? He asks. Huh. Once. Is that what you said? I nod. Would you like to try again? I don't know what to say. I just look at him. I shake my head slowly and look at my typewriter again. You don't have to give me an answer right now, Jerry. Think it over. He leaves my room. Gail comes back half an hour later. Did you meet Bill yet? I say, yes, he wasn't very comfortable around me. Don't be too hard on him. He's never worked with people who have cerebral palsy. I start laughing. Yeah, and Bill wants to teach a guy with cerebral palsy to walk. Yes, that is funny. But Jerry, you could teach Bill a lot just by dropping by the therapy room. I have my writing, I say. It takes all my time and energy. Jerry, you just told me you're having a hard time with your writing. Maybe you need a change. I yell, I'm a writer. I don't have time to play around with a guy who wants to be a therapist. It would be a waste of time. Stop yelling, she yells. You're harder to understand. I point out that she is yelling too. Sorry. I smile. You're much nicer this way, she says. You are too. We're speaking in normal tones again. I ask her, what if Bill really could teach me to walk? She thinks for a second. A good ending to a story, she says with a grin. She closes the door as she leaves. I just stare at my typewriter. The people who drive by my window experience the whole world. What might have happened if I could have worked with Mr. Sutter just a little longer? It's been over 10 years since he tried to teach me to walk at day school. What if I had tried just a bit harder? Would I have learned to walk? What would my life be like if I could? I start looking out the window and thinking for a while. Then I take a nap until it's time for dinner. I aim for the dining room to join Chuck and Rick for dinner. Our trays come. It's dry meatloaf. When we finish eating, Gail takes Chuck back to his room. Rick goes out on the patio, and I push my chair through the lounge instead of going straight to my room. When I wheel a little farther down the hall, I'm startled when Leslie suddenly walks out of the front office. There usually isn't anyone in that part of the hall at this time of day. Hey there, Jerry. Hi, Leslie. How was dinner? Not very good. Warmed over meatloaf and creamed peas. Warmed over what? Meatloaf. Oh, that sounds yummy, she says, smiling at me. Still hungry? A little. I'm going to go out and pick up a hamburger and a malt and bring them back here to eat. Would you like me to get you a malt? You can join me when I get back. My treat. You can drink a malt, can't you? Sometimes Leslie fills in as a cook and she remembers I can only eat soft food. I nod. It must be nice to go out whenever you want and order what you want to eat. Good, she says, sounding like she's glad I said yes. I have money, I offer. You can pay next time, she tells me, and already walking back towards her office. Next time? The look on my face must have been one of complete confusion. I don't even try to answer or respond. Her words silence me for a minute. Next time. She's already thinking about doing this again. She's already planning to get together with me for another malt. She goes into her office, stacks some of the papers and folders on her desk, turns out the light, and locks the door. She then turns to me and tells me she'll be back in 20 minutes and will meet me in the lounge. I just nod and mumble okay, and she starts walking toward the employee exit. I'm still processing what she said about next time. I do not think she realizes what a big deal this is for me. I'm really excited about having a malt with her. This kind of spontaneous, fun activity with a friend is rare here in the hospital. Everything here is on a fixed schedule, assembly line style, and no frills. I could really get used to malts and fun and girls. Oh, my. While she's gone, my mood picks up, and I'm ready to have some fun, drink my malt, and enjoy talking to Leslie. When Leslie comes back with her dinner and my malt, we sit down at one of the tables in the lounge. She opens my straw, takes the lid off my malt, and positions it so I can reach the straw and drink it on my own. She starts eating her hamburger. She's obviously hungry, and she doesn't say much for a few minutes. Finally, she slows down and says, "I don't think I'll have time tonight to work on your story. We can do that another night when I don't have so many files to update and put away." "Okay," I tell her. "I'll work on it some more in the meantime." I try to say this slowly so she'll understand. "Did you say you're going to work on it more?" Leslie asks. "Yes." "Okay, great. Maybe next Tuesday we can get together in the evening and go over it. Is that okay with you?" "Yes, and I have an outline for a new story." "Did you say new story?" I nod. "Great," she says, and drinks some of her malt. "Hopefully, we'll have time to do both." After taking another bite of her hamburger, she asks, "Jerry, are you going to sign up for physical therapy and try to walk?" "Yes, no, I don't know." "How did you know?" "I heard Bill mention it to the director this afternoon that he thought you might." "I don't think so," I say, feeling like I must look a bit downcast. She says, "Sometimes I would come out of my office when the former physical therapist was working with one of the residents. It looked dangerous sometimes. Couldn't you fall and get hurt?" I lean back in my chair. "Yes, I could." I think about the time Mr. Sutter glanced at his watch and I fell. I never could trust him after that day. 10 years ago, I said, when I was 15, I tried walking and I fell. It scared me more than physically hurt me, but I never got my confidence back after that. I didn't realize that. It must have been horrible, but it must have been very important for you to be able to walk. It was. Back then, I wanted to be accepted and to be able to do more with my life. She says, "You don't have to be able to walk for me to accept you as a person, Jerry. And I'm scared to think about you falling or being disappointed if it doesn't work. You are someone special, you know." "Me?" "Yes, you." She reaches over and holds my malt steady while I drink. And then she touches my arm. "But you know me," I say, "and you work here. You know all kinds of people with disabilities. Others outside of here could get to know you, too." "How?" "Well, you could start going to school. You'd meet all kinds of people that way. There's a program that would pick you up each day and take you to the local community college so you could take classes." "Maybe. I don't know." I think about that idea. I'm not sure if I want to do it or not. But it might help my writing. Maybe I could take a writing class. I start getting excited about the prospect of that. There'd be girls at a college, too. You might even meet a nice girl. How did she know what I was thinking? Not in this wheelchair. She leans back. "Why not?" "Could I find a girlfriend if I'm in a wheelchair and not able to walk?" "I think so. She doesn't have to base her love on whether or not another person is in a wheelchair." "Well, could you love me?" "Jerry, when I look at you, I see a very intelligent and kind man." She finishes her hamburger and malt. I'm done with mine, too. She picks up our cups and papers and drops them into the trash can. "I have to get back to my office and finish working on those files. I'll see you tomorrow. We can do this again and talk some more. It's your treat next time." "Okay." She starts to leave and then suddenly turns around, bends down, and kisses me on the cheek. Before I can say anything, she turns around and goes back to her office. I stay in the lounge after Leslie leaves and watch TV for a while. Some of the other residents come and go as I sit there. As I wheel back to my room to go to bed, I think about what Leslie said. I switch on the light over my typewriter. Everything that happened today is running through my mind. Not being able to walk always seemed to be the thing that would keep me from really having a decent life. For that reason, I was never able to write about it before. Now I can. All the painful memories of learning to walk and of falling are still there. This time I experienced those bad memories mixed with the good memories of my evening with Leslie. The drapes on my window are closed. My writer's block has disappeared. Instead of going to bed right away, I work on the outline for my new story. There's a smile on my face as I write. ¶¶
Friends, that was Howard Hurt reading a good ending to a story. Of course, right off the bat, we're made aware that our author tonight, Joe Hemphill, has cerebral palsy and lives in a hospital. Gail is the aide that takes care of him. She tells him that there is a new physical therapist on board who would like to see him. Unfortunately, that brings back a lot of pain and anguish about what happened 10 years earlier when another therapist tried to get him to walk. In the process, he fell and severely hurt himself. The more he thinks about it, and the more they try to talk him into going to see this therapist, the more it looks like he's just not interested. Our second story tonight is by Bakersfield author Bill McDougall. His story is entitled Bertha in Stillwell. Here is Carolyn Carter to read it for us. Bertha in Stillwell.
I was standing by my window on one cold, cloudy day when I saw that
Bertha in Stillwell. Bertha May shivered as she closed the outhouse door and started up the short path to the small, unpainted clapboard house that was, for now, called home. It was early Sunday morning, and the sun was just beginning to rise over Davis Mountain and warm the misty August air in the woodlands south of Stillwell, Oklahoma. She rubbed the goosebumps off her arms and wondered if the chill she felt was from the slight breeze or if it was caused by something deeper. She questioned whether she could be cold outside when she felt such a heated emotion growing within her. She steadied her hands and flexed her aching fingers. In the dim light, she saw that they were raw and stained. Resentment welled up inside her. The whole day yesterday. The whole day. Over to the Smith's place, picking walnuts. She wiped her palms back and forth on her worn dress, but the dark green stain didn't come off. Bet other girls don't have to work to help pay rent. That thought was added to the mental list of everything that was going wrong in her life, a list that was growing larger as each day in August passed, a list that was fed by her wariness. A list that began when she first realized that September was coming, and with it, the start of another school year. She stepped onto the worn wooden planks placed around the rusted well pump. She raised and lowered the handle until the water ran into the oak bucket sitting below the spout. Putting her hands into the cold water, she splashed it onto her face. Small cuts in her fingers made her wince and look at her palms. "My hands look old. Old, ugly and stained. It wasn't this way when Daddy was... before Daddy..." She stopped as the familiar tightness filled her chest and choked back her words. She sat down on the stump of a fallen tree and tightly shut her eyes to stem the flow of tears. But the memories were too close and pressed in on her, coming too quickly to hold them back. She remembered the coarse, rough wood of the coffin and the bare, stark loneliness of the cemetery. She frowned as she thought of the months following her father's death. Her mother, with 4 children and no means of support, being forced to live on the charity of relatives. They had been shuffled between her mother's 4 brothers in the Versailles, Missouri area. Sometimes they stayed together, but more often were separated because there wasn't enough room for all of them. They were taken in by uncles and aunts that Bertha hardly knew and who had their own families to take care of during worsening economic times. She was young but still sensed by their behavior that though they would rather die than say it out loud, they did not need the additional burden of supporting their sister and her 4 children. Then her mother married Jim and life became even more nomadic. She recalled the first move to Carthage, Missouri. She and her brothers had enrolled in school there and were getting to know the other kids. Bertha enjoyed learning and realized that education could be the way to a better life. Then suddenly they left in the middle of the night under the cover of darkness. In the following years, the family lived in Diamond, Granby, and Neosho, other towns and places they had stayed for too short a time to even think of enrolling in school. They had traveled through Arkansas and into Oklahoma, always moving before she could complete a year of school or even say goodbye to the friends she made. It took little time to pack up their possessions, a few dishes, pots and pans, and the clothing they were wearing. A shiver made her get up and continue to the house. She opened the back door and stepped in. Bessie had a fire going in the wood stove and turned her head to see who entered the kitchen. "Bertha, you're up awful early," she drawled in her thick Missouri accent. Bertha didn't respond. She sat down at the rough table that her stepfather, Jim, had made from salvaged wood and scavenged nails after they had rented this house 2 months ago. As she looked around, she thought how much nicer the last house had been, or even the one before that. She added that to her list of grievances. "Mama, we're going to have to move again." Bessie sighed and turned the leftover biscuits warming on the stove. "I don't know for sure. I reckon it pretty much depends on whether Jim gets work or if he don't." "Been gone 3 days. Don't that mean he's been working?" "Not for sure. Could be he's had to try over to Lion Switch. It'd take him a mite to get there afoot." She glanced over her shoulder, her faded blue eyes framed in wrinkles, evidence of the weariness of hard work and harder times. She gave her daughter a look, inviting an ally against her growing anxiety. "So many folks are out of a job. Lots looking for work, little to be had. Remember last time he had to stay down to Zion, working for that mill for a week? And he come home with his pockets empty." Bessie didn't have to say anything. Just her quickly knitted brow and the wave of her wooden spoon told Bertha she'd best not continue that tone of voice. She used the spoon to scoop out a large glob of bacon grease from a tin can and plop it into the blackened iron skillet. It hissed and began to spatter. After enough time had elapsed that she felt she could go on, Bertha said quietly, "But it just ain't fair." Bessie sprinkled a small amount of flour into the grease and continued to stir. "Mama, I'm 14 years old, and I ain't been to school regular since Daddy died. I'm keeping the Johnson kids every day of the week, and I come home to help with the chores on the weekends." She looked at her mother for her reaction. "School's going to take up next month." She paused. "Mama, you hear me?" Bessie nodded, continuing to stir slowly. She did not turn to face her daughter for fear her eyes would reveal the tears that had suddenly pooled there, blurring her vision. She did not turn to face her daughter lest her expression of deep sadness convey her inner pain. "I ain't going back to school, am I?" Bertha put her elbows on the table and rested her chin in her palms. "Not ever?" "Gravy's ready. Go fetch the young'uns." "Mama, I'm asking you." Bessie dropped the spoon into the gravy and turned around. "Berthy, it's 1928. Your daddy's been dead 3 years, and there's nothing can be done about that. This is where we're at right now, right here. There's other folks is hurting, too. We ain't the onlyest ones." She put her hands on her hips. Her frustration spilled over into anger. "I'm sorry for you young'uns having to work so hard and having nothing near enough to eat. But Jim's doing the best he can, and I'm doing the best I can, and you'll just have to do the best you can. Complaining will just get you a lap full of trouble." She paused, then continued, her voice softer. "I'm sorry, Bertha, but it don't look like we can spare you to go to school." "But, Mama..." "Hush now, there ain't no more to be said." "Why are you and Bertha fussing?" Bessie looked at Mildred as she entered the kitchen, rubbing the sleep out of her eyes. Bertha's younger sister was thin, with hollow-set dark eyes that seemed to peer out through a pale, emaciated facial mask. "We ain't fussing, Mildred. Just getting breakfast ready. Sit down the table. Bertha, get your brothers up. They can't sleep all day." Later, when Wendy and Floyd were seated at the table, Bessie tore a biscuit in half on each of their plates, then poured a small amount of thin gravy over each half. "Where's yours, Mama?" Mildred noticed that Bessie did not have a plate. "Oh, I ain't of a good mood to eat right now. I'll eat a bit later." Bertha exchanged a knowing look with Wendy. They were old enough to realize that there was little to eat in the house and that their mother was not eating because there wasn't enough to go around. The rest of the morning passed quickly as Bessie and the girls washed and mended clothing and the boys foraged for firewood. Shortly before noon, Bessie brought them all together. "We're going over to the Hollow and see if there ain't still some berries." The Hollow was what the locals called the wooded lowland area to the southeast of Stillwell. It was between Davis Mountain to the north and Taylor Mountain to the south, with Salisaw Creek running diagonally between them. During the humid Oklahoma summers, the Hollow on both sides of the creek was nearly impassable, with blackberry vines that hung thick with sweet, juicy berries. "They's mostly picked over," Wendy said. He often ventured to the Hollow for adventure and had been there recently. "Well, I got a little flour I've been saving, and if there's any berries left, we can make a cobbler." She optimistically gave each child a square of flour sack cloth to carry berries in. "Let's get afore it's too late." It was late afternoon when they came to a spot Wendy had told them about. They had meandered along a narrow path, stopping frequently to pick a few berries, but as Wendy had predicted, there were few left, and they quickly ate the ones they did find. Wendy's previously discovered spot was a clearing divided by the creek. Rock outcroppings and large flat granite slabs kept the vegetation from closing off the area. They all removed their shoes and waded into the cool water. The boys wandered down the creek, searching for a pool in which they could try to catch minnows. Bessie and the girl sat on a flat rock shaded by an ancient oak. They stared at the water, the sky, the green woodlands surrounding them, and listened to the hum and buzz of unseen insects. Bertha frowned and, remembering her mental list, added, "No berry cobbler."
Will the circle be unbroken?
Bertha and Mildred looked at their mother, who had begun to sing. Her voice was soft and clear, and the natural acoustics of the Hollow amplified it, lending fullness and richness to the melody. Bertha looked back at the water. She loved to sing, and the family enjoyed many evenings learning the words and melodies to songs and hymns. But now she was trying to ignore the emotion stirring within her, which threatened to lift her dour mood. Mildred began singing with her mother on the first verse, her D chord easily bonding with her mother's lead in B and her young falsetto blending into harmony. Bertha felt her spirit rise and joined in on the refrain. She effortlessly slipped into bass G, completing the three-part harmony. Their voices rose and reverberated through the woodlands in the Hollow. A short distance away, the boys stopped their play and listened. Before the last notes of the melody echoed faintly into the Hollow, Mildred took the lead in singing another favorite hymn. Bessie and Bertha easily took their parts in the new harmony. They sang with their hearts, the notes lifting their spirits and sweeping away the fears, the uncertainties, the doubts, and hardships that confronted them in their daily lives. They sang with a renewed joy of existence and with the simple satisfaction of the moment. They sang as one, fused together by the healing salve of human voices raised in praise. As they finished the notes of a final song, silence returned to the Hollow. Then, starting faintly, somewhere in the highlands surrounding them, someone began clapping. Other hands joined in. The applause grew until the Hollow was filled with the sounds of an unseen audience. Bertha and Mildred blushed and gave their mother a quizzical look. Bessie wore an expression of surprised delight. "Well, I reckon there's people living up in the Hollow. We surely must have been singing to a whole passel of folks, know it or not." "They liked it, Mama." Bertha looked up at the expanse of the woodland. "They liked our singing." Bessie looked down at her daughters. "I'm of a mind we ease some of their troubles." She looked at Bertha. "And maybe some of our own. They began the long trek home. When the narrow path widened enough, Bertha caught up to her mother and, reaching out, took her hand. Their eyes met, and for the first time that day, Bertha smiled.
That was Carolyn Carter reading Bertha in Stillwell by Bill McDougall. The story certainly reminds us of those Depression days of the 30s and how difficult things were for the folks who lived in Oklahoma at the time. It's hard to imagine how a family like Bertha's could be much worse off. They seemed to barely survive on the most basic items of food, shelter, and clothing. It was Bessie who suggested that they go to what everybody around there called the Hollow to pick berries. But when they got there, even the berries were picked over. No berry cobbler, Mother frowned. As they looked at each other, for some reason they began to sing. And after they finished, they actually heard applause inasmuch as other families in the Hollow, people they hadn't even realized were out there, appreciated their singing. Friends, our first author tonight, Joe Hemphill, attended schools for children with cerebral palsy. He then studied writing at Cypress College and at Cal State Long Beach. When he moved to Fresno, he attended Fresno City College. He has written several columns and many letters to the Fresno Bee, and in 2010, he self-published his first novel entitled Keeping Up Jerry. We're also pleased to mention that Howard Hurt, who read Joe's story tonight, has also written a book entitled Double Drop. And our second author tonight, Bill McDougall, heard the story he read for us from his aged mother as she remembered those desperate Depression days of the 30s in Oklahoma. Thank you both for your stories tonight, Joe Hemphill and Bill McDougall. We hope that both of you have more stories to share with us in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another episode of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Hope Nisley. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.